From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. It's a wild morning, even by D.C. standards. House Speaker Pelosi accused the president of engaging in a cover-up. Trump stormed out of a bipartisan infrastructure meeting, walked to the Rose Garden, and blasted Democrats. He said he won't work on an infrastructure deal until Democrats stop investigating him. We'll have the latest after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a good start to your day. Later this hour, a Northern California couple has won the right to produce a child using sperm retrieved from their son after his death in a skiing accident. The judge's decision has created a swirl of controversy. We'll talk about the precedent and its implications. But first, as you just heard on NPR News, the battle between the president and congressional Democrats has escalated. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi earlier this morning.
It was a very positive meeting, a respectful sharing of ideas, and I think a very impressive presentation by our chairs. We do believe that it's important for to follow the facts. We believe that no one is above the law, including the President of the United States, and we believe that the President of the United States is engaged in a cover-up.
Well, and those words apparently angered the president, because shortly after she made that statement, a bipartisan White House meeting scheduled. The president abruptly walked out 5 minutes into the meeting. He headed over to the Rose Garden and unloaded.
So I came here to do a meeting on infrastructure with Democrats, not really thinking they wanted to do infrastructure or anything else other than investigate. And I just saw that Nancy Pelosi, just before our meeting, made a statement that we believe that the President of the United States is engaged in a cover-up.
And then the president went on.
This is what happened. No collusion. No obstruction, no nothing. They issued 50 orders authorizing use of pen registers. Think of that, though. 500 witnesses. And then I have Nancy Pelosi go out and say that the President of the United States engaged in a cover-up. Now, we've had a House investigation. We have Senate investigations. We have investigations like nobody's ever had before, and there's nothing, we did nothing wrong. They would have loved to have said we colluded. They would have loved it. These people were out to get us.
Now, the president used prepared charts as part of making his case for cooperating with the Mueller investigation, leading one to believe that his walking out wasn't completely spontaneous. Trump went on to say he won't work with Democrats on infrastructure legislation until they stop investigating him. Shortly after the president's surprise Rose Garden appearance, Pelosi and Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer faced the cameras.
We had hoped that we could give this president an opportunity to have a signature infrastructure initiative to create jobs, to improve the quality of life, to just do so much for our country. For some reason, maybe it was lack of confidence on his part, that he really couldn't match the greatness of the challenge that we have, wasn't really respectful of the Congress and the White House working together. He just took a pass. And it just makes me wonder why he did that.
And Nancy Pelosi went on to say that she is praying for the president. This all plays out alongside House Democrats' differences over whether to pursue impeachment proceedings. Pelosi led a meeting this morning to talk through those differences. So we're bringing you up to date on all this and then looking at the potential implications. With us from the Los Angeles Times, congressional reporter Jennifer Habercorn. Jennifer, a wild morning this morning. Did anyone see this Rose Garden appearance coming?
No, I don't think so. It was definitely a wild morning. You know, we started the day thinking that this impeachment division between House Democrats was going to kind of rule the day. But the president really changed that when he ended this infrastructure effort. You know, infrastructure is one of the things that House Democrats had really been looking forward to. They have always been talking about how they wanted to do their investigations on one track and bipartisan policy, infrastructure being at the top of the list on the other track. And that seems to be off the table now.
Jennifer, what's a little unclear, as I mentioned, there were these prepared charts, you know, showing the number of witnesses who appeared as part of the Mueller investigation, the president making the case contrary to obstruction. Here's how cooperative we were. So it would appear those had been prepared in advance. Have you gotten any details as to whether he was planning to use them for some other event or you know, just keeping them for when he thought the time was right, or whether the Rose Garden appearance might have been planned, you know, further back and not spontaneous?
You know, I don't know where those posters came from, but they, you know, weren't something that could be prepared at the last minute. I will say there's been a lot of back and forth on infrastructure, so it wasn't terribly surprising that it kind of went down in flames. You know, the Congress has kind of put its toe in the water about moving forward with the deal to get pushback, and the White House has and gotten pushback. So, you know, infrastructure was always going to be a very heavy lift, even though it's the most bipartisan thing that Congress is even talking about right now. And there had been signs of progress and then signs of setback. And, you know, this is really an effort that seems to have never really gotten off the ground. I don't know if it's the cynic in me covering this place for a couple of years that, you know, made it look like infrastructure was not you know, bound to happen. But I don't think that Pelosi's comments today were what sealed its fate.
All right. What about that meeting that Pelosi presided over with the different factions, you know, strategically at odds over impeachment? What, you know, what's your sense of what came out of that?
You know, I think the effort in this meeting was to really get Democrats all on the same page and to take down the temperature that had really risen really in the last 48 hours over impeachment. The former White House counsel, Don McGahn, really snubbed the House Judiciary Committee on Tuesday by not showing up for his hearing. And that really inflamed tensions among the Democrats, particularly progressives and members of that committee, saying, you know, if the White House is just going to snub us on every single subpoena, we need to move forward with impeachment. They're giving us no option. And as you know, Pelosi has long advocated for a slow-go approach on the impeachment inquiry process. And, you know, the caucus was moving a little further than she wanted them to. So this meeting was designed to kind of catch everybody up, to lay out the facts that they had some wins in their favor. They had a court ruling just a couple days ago that basically said Congress has a right to investigate the executive branch. And Pelosi's message was, you know, latch on to these wins. More is coming. There's more investigations coming. We don't need to all be saying impeachment right now.
We're going to talk about the legal issues at play over the president telling his former White House counselor not to testify before the House committee and these competing issues between the oversight role of the House of Representatives and the power of the presidency and how those are legally at odds. But Jennifer, I was just wondering, you know, at this point, what is the sense that you are getting from Democrats as to whether there really is enough of an appetite to move forward on impeachment? Obviously, their leader, Nancy Pelosi, does not think strategically that's the best approach, at least now.
As of right now, there's not enough support to pursue impeachment. It's really the most vocal members of the caucus who are advocating for it, but a lot of the moderates are skeptical that it's going to be a winner. You know, Pelosi put out some parameters in the beginning saying the public needs to be behind us, it needs to have bipartisan support, and there needs to be overwhelming evidence. And there, a lot of members feel like that's just not there. Also, they know the reality is that even if they get an impeachment measure through the House, it would just die in the Senate. So the president would still be in office, but he would just have a cudgel to talk about. He would just say, House Democrats, They just want to impeach me. They're the enemy. And Pelosi's concern is that that would be costly in the 2020 election for both the presidency and the House.
Yeah, I was reading some conservative commentators last night who thought the president was attempting to goad Democrats in the House into impeachment, potentially seeing it as a political benefit to him. Interestingly, this morning, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, a frequent guest on this and every other program, said that he is not going to pursue contempt against Don McGahn after the Justice Department agreed to unmask portions of the Mueller report that deal with intelligence issues. Jennifer, you know anything more about that?
Yeah, this is an inquiry that Schiff has been going after for a while. It's a little different than some of the documents that other House committees are going are pursuing, particularly in McGahn. McGahn refused to testify before a different panel on Tuesday, not Schiff's panel. So there's multiple inquiries going on in different committees right now.
Jennifer, thanks very much. Really appreciate your bringing us up to date. I know a very busy day for you, and we appreciate your time.
Great to talk with you. Thanks.
Thank you. Los Angeles Times congressional reporter Jennifer Habercorn with us on Air Talks. My question for you is, what do you think strategically is in Democrats' best interests? Now, I'm not talking about your personal opinion, whether you favor impeaching the president or not, but what do you think strategically is the best thing for Democrats to do and why? Does it make sense to pursue impeachment? Does it make sense to keep up the investigative pressure but not go down the road to impeachment? What do you think is the smartest political approach for Democrats to take? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. You can also tweet at Air Talk. You can post on the Air Talk Facebook page and post on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. With me, Republican political analyst, partner of Wilson Walsh Consulting in San Francisco, and frequent analyst with us, Sean T. Walsh. Sean, good morning. Thank you for being with us. Just first, before we get into the Democratic strategy here, your thoughts about, you know, sort of where we stand with the rhetoric ratcheting up this morning?
Well, if you're a Republican, you're actually sitting back and kind of chuckling, because we're used to having Republicans be in a circle, you know, and firing at each other. You've got the Democrats on various, you know, spectrum of the party attacking each other. It's causing grief for Nancy Pelosi from a leadership perspective. You got the AOC issue where she pops out every now and then. So, you know, we're just happy to sit back and watch the show.
Do you think that there is potential political to the benefit of the president of him being impeached, knowing how unlikely it is that the Senate would remove him from office?
Well, I guess there's some political benefit. I mean, the president doesn't do anything, in my view, to help lift his polls up. He's got his base and they are fully with him. He doesn't seem to want to reach out and bring other people forward. So does it reinforce people's beliefs that Donald Trump is being attacked unfairly by Democrats in Congress and many in the media? Yeah. So does it help him long term politically? I don't know. The real question I have is, what dynamic does this have for the 2020 election, not just for the president, but for the 25 U.S. Senate seats that Republicans are going to have to defend in the Senate? So I do think that if the Democrats come off as, you know, Don Quixote-like tilting at the Donald Trump impeachment proceedings, the Republicans have a weapon to say, look, they didn't get infrastructure done. They didn't get anything done. The House has been completely tied up in this, you know, witch hunt insofar as the Justice Department didn't put the goods up on Trump. And so we need to stay in office, and we need more Republicans. And so I do think this has potentially long-term benefits in the 2020 election for contested Republican seats.
Do you feel as though the president is attempting to bait the House into impeaching him?
Absolutely. And it's not just bait the House into impeaching him. He's baiting the House into continuing its food fight in the, you know, cafeteria. You get some people say, don't impeach. You get some people say, impeach. Then you've got Amash who comes out on the Republican side that throws gas onto the fire. And it makes it difficult for Pelosi, who I think has wisely not wanted to go the impeachment route, to keep the investigative pressure on. So this is just more, you know, turmoil for Pelosi leadership and more turmoil for the Democrats. And, you know, the one thing Donald Trump is, I don't think he's a uniter, but he can be a pretty good divider. And I think he's dividing the Democrats in the House, and they're playing along lock, stock and barrel.
Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst, will be back with him momentarily. But also with us is Cenk Uygur, the host creator of the online news show, The Young Turks. He provides a progressive voice. Cenk, thank you for being with us.
No problem. Can't wait to weigh in on all the wrong things that have been said so far.
Okay. All right. Wrong from your perspective. We understand. So why do you think it would be to Democrats' strategic benefit to impeach?
All right. First of all, it's got to be noted for the record that whether it's to Democrats' strategic benefit or not, you must abide by the law. We have to have rule of law in this country. And it, I would find it completely unacceptable if Democratic leadership said, yeah, the president broke the law, which we all know he did. He committed two felonies. That's clear as day. But we're going to let him go because it benefits us politically. That would be a horrible thing to say. And that's exactly what Nancy said.
What are the two felonies you're referring to?
Campaign finance violations. His co-conspirator is in prison as we speak for that same exact crime. There is absolutely no dispute of it. And obstruction of justice, Mueller said 12 different instances of it, and he said Congress should act. So there's no lack of clarity whatsoever on it. The idea that the Mueller report vindicated him is hilarious. If it did, why was it a witch hunt? He keeps saying 18 angry Democrats did this witch hunt, which showed that I was exonerated. What? The fact that no one ever points out that logical fallacy is insane. No, if it exonerated you, you would say that it was done by wonderful people who were not doing a witch hunt. Yet we have these nonsense conversations. I mean, speaking of nonsense conversations, you think does anyone in their right mind really think that Trump is looking forward to getting impeached? What? The whole national conversation is insane. Of course he's not looking forward to it. He despises the idea. It would ruin his reputation in his own mind. The idea that Trump thinks two steps ahead, let alone three steps ahead, and thinks, oh, strategically, if I'm impeached, that'll be wonderful for me and my legacy and my political chances. Hilarious. No.
So you don't think, Cenk, that he likes playing the victim?
But here's the other part of it. First of all, he is the biggest crybaby ever. Somebody's got to say the emperor has no clothes. The man is mentally unstable. Here's the president of the...
Cenk, settle down, Cenk. Go ahead.
No. But wait a minute. Does anybody in their right mind actually think he's mentally stable? Here's the president of the United States on Twitter today, crying like a little baby, saying, oh, my polls would be 65%, but there's witch hunt and the hoax against me and a conspiracy theory. He sounds like Alex Jones. He's completely and utterly unhinged.
So your point is you think that his demeanor is so unacceptable in a president that, too, should fuel the impeachment proceedings against him.
I think they should have done the 25th Amendment against him a long time ago. He screamed on Twitter that he's known for two things, being like a smart person. He literally wrote that down, and being mentally stable. Anyone who brags about being mentally stable is not mentally stable. Okay, so now back to this. So Nancy Pelosi helps the Republicans more than anyone alive, because since we have two clear felonies, that any rational party, let alone an opposing party, should clearly move forward. But when she doesn't, what it does is it validates the talking point of Republicans like, hey, this is an open question. Even your leader says that she doesn't want to move forward because it's not clear enough. I can't imagine a bigger gift to the Republican Party, as usual, handed to them on a silver platter by Nancy Pelosi, the most incompetent leader we've ever had, who the rest of Washington calls a master legislator. Does this look like a master legislator to you guys?
All right. We're talking with Cenk Uygur, creator and host of The Young Turks, the progressive online news show. Sean T. Walsh, Republican political consultant with us. Let's take a couple listener calls. We begin with Richard in Mar Vista. Richard, do you think it makes sense for Democrats to pursue impeachment, and why?
Absolutely. I think we have to observe the rule of law, whether our would-be dictator thinks that's the way to go or not. I think your Young Turk individual was right on until he started trashing Nancy Pelosi. If it weren't for Nancy Pelosi's deliberate and adult thinking, the Democrats would have gone unhinged a lot sooner and made for more fodder for the Republicans. But I think even if the Senate kills impeachment, as the gentleman did say, the Democrats would go on the record as observing the rule of law, and the ultimate arbiter of the president's future will be the voters, who in 2020 will have more ammunition to use to elect the next and hopefully more qualified president.
Richard, I appreciate your call. Thanks very much. Richard in Mar Vista says, makes sense for Democrats to impeach the president. I'm asking you strategically, do you think it makes sense or not? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Stephanie in Englewood, what do you think?
I think that it's with 34 individuals that have charges, 7 guilty pleas, that Mueller charged who he was going to charge and the criminal indictments occurred. I think if Trump was going to be charged or something was going to happen, it would have happened. What the Democrats are better served strategically in doing is, as they campaign, highlight how they're different. Highlight how I believe almost every Republican finds abhorrent his behavior. On the campaign trail, talk about, I'm going to say this and I'm going to write this and I can spell. I'm going to say this, I'm going to write this, and I don't sound like I've maybe had a few drinks. I work with these people, and none of them have indictments against them.
All right.
The key points that will define how they're different, because if a charge was going to happen, it would have happened.
Stephanie, I appreciate it very much. Thank you so much. 866-893-KPECC. Harry Littman, former U.S. attorney and deputy assistant AG in the Clinton administration. He's UCLA and UC San Diego professor of constitutional law. Professor Littman, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I do want to ask you first, Cenk Uygur raised a couple of issues that he thought were clear felonies on the part of the president. Others would say there's more gray area here. One, the campaign finance issue to which Cohen pled guilty as part of his plea agreement. We've certainly had dueling scholars on that issue. The other, obstruction of justice, where Mueller did not make a recommendation or a conclusion about whether the president obstructed justice, but certainly left the door open for Congress to further investigate that. Is it clear to you that both of those were violations of the law by the president?
Let me take the second one first, Larry, and I take your question. I'm sure that's how you mean it, that if he were somebody else, because they have this little awkward problem of not being able to indict the president.
Yes, and thank you for saying, yeah, I'm taking that out of the equation.
Is really, the clear answer is yes. It's almost indisputable. You probably saw that nearly 1,000 former prosecutors of all stripes have weighed in and said the same. And as a former prosecutor, when you really bear down on the specific episodes that Mueller lays out, and I'm thinking specifically about the command from Trump to McGahn to basically shut the investigation down, and the command to him to lie and write a memo saying Trump never did it. That's obstruction any day of the week, any office in the country, and anywhere, anyhow. I just don't think that's a close call. Now, on the campaign finance, I think that remains slightly underdeveloped. That is, there because of Trump's successful maneuvering to keep from answering questions from Mueller, there would be a few facts that I think, as a prosecutor, you'd want to fill in involving the sort of backside communications between Trump and Cohen for him to actually be implicated in the conspiracy. But it's pretty close already, including the tape conversation we already know about. So that
okay.
be a judgment call, but I think it's likely that most offices would indict that as well.
We're talking with Professor Harry Litman, UCLA and UC San Diego constitutional law specialist, former U.S. attorney, and the creator and executive producer of the Talking Feds podcast. Harry, also wanted to ask you about the impasse between the president asking Don McGahn, his former White House counsel, not to testify for the House Intelligence Committee. You've got multiple House committees that are, through subpoenas, attempting to get members of the administration or former members to testify. So who legally has the upper hand here?
Yeah, both legally and practically. So asking is a nice way to put it. But he ordered him to stand down, but on the basis of a very expansive and aggressive theory, which is that because McGahn was previously so close an advisor to him, the president, enjoys testimonial immunity. That means McGahn can be ordered not even to show up. I think it is pretty clear that there'd be a lot of content that Trump could try to say is covered by executive privilege. But that's the sort of thing you do piece by piece and can be pierced. What he's trying to do is never have McGahn in the chair and avoid the sort of Klieg-like moment of, as we had with John Dean and Watergate. My best assessment is that Congress has the somewhat better argument here. That is, Congress has an argument that the better argument that he's got to show up, and then he can assert on individual pieces of testimony. But it's not easy, because in past conflicts like this, the parties have worked it out, and so there aren't court cases. And it's the kind of thing that could go all the way up. And I wrote about this morning in the Washington Post. There's this almost nightmarish scenario that it all comes down to Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, who, even if they're deciding in good faith, could have the sort of views of executive power that makes them side with Trump. And what a terrible mess for the country, that would be. But
sure.
So my personal assessment is Congress has the upper hand, but it's not conclusive.
So, Professor, as you're describing this, is essentially a matter of whether you see the presidency or the Congress as the preeminent branch, as opposed to who has oversight, who has, because you could also look at it, couldn't you, in the division of powers as the being co-equal branches, but particular areas where one's authority might supersede the others?
Yeah, well, I don't want to say supersede. They are co-equal. But it's clear, for example, that they couldn't make Trump appear there tomorrow, as a president, just like in the same way Trump couldn't order, the Pelosi, or if they had some kind of testimony. So the question is whether that kind of preeminence that he has, not that he's greater than Congress, but whether his former White House counsel is cloaked in the same kind of deference. And I think the better answer is probably no. It's not. They try to argue that this is the same as calling the president. That's how important and serious it is. But I think probably it's not. But the argument's not that the Congress is more equal or less equal, but rather just that, look, this guy's a former advisor. He's not even a current advisor. He's not the president. He can, there's nothing that special about him. The information he has.
Yeah. So he could just refuse to divulge answers to the questions he's asked.
And that would then you'd serve that up to the courts. Is this piece of information? That's what happened in Nixon.
Is it privilege?
Say the people couldn't show up. He wanted to say this tape and that conversation was protected. The court said no. The court said there is executive privilege, but it has to give way to surpassing need. That's what should be happening here, I think.
We're talking with Professor Harry Litman, constitutional law expert, UCLA and UC San Diego, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Clinton administration. Let me go back to Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst. Your response to what Cenk Uygur was saying, that it's quite clear the president committed two felonies, one on the campaign finance with the money paid to two women, including Stormy Daniels, who allegedly had sex with him, the other obstruction of justice, as detailed in the Mueller report.
Well, two things. I agree with, I guess the bottom line issue is, and I agree with the former Justice Department official, you can't indict a sitting president. Mueller took that position, the Department of Justice, in two separate memos, both in the Clinton impeachment proceedings as well as the Nixon impeachment proceedings, held that up. So I guess the bottom line issue, does it matter at this juncture?
Well, except that impeachment would be in lieu of criminally prosecuting the president.
So that's right, Larry. But that was, you asked me the question with regards to, did he commit these crimes, and
yeah.
So what can happen? So, yes, he can be impeached, and they can decide. On the specific issue with regards to campaign finance law, I actually don't believe he violated the law there. The law basically says that a presidential candidate can spend unlimited funds for his campaign purposes, number one. And number two, with regards to if this ever went to court in the Stormy Daniels issue, I think the president could say, look, you know, the bottom line was I made this payment. It wasn't designed to influence a campaign. It was designed to save my marriage. It was a private matter. So I do think he would be successful, and it's not clear cut that he actually violated the law. With regards to obstruction of justice, again, you know, you've got a guy who worked in the White House for two presidents and two governors. Not a former Department of Justice lawyer, but I would argue that historically, with regards to obstruction, there wasn't witness tampering, there wasn't bribery, there weren't the traditional obstruction issues. And the underlying issue with regards to did Trump or his campaign collude with the Russians was basically not determined in the Mueller report. So the rest of this stuff is just noise, and I think it's in the realm of politics.
All right. I want to thank our guest, Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, host and creator of the progressive online news show, The Young Turks, Cenk Uygur, Harry Litman, former U.S. attorney, and the creator, executive producer of the Talking Feds podcast. Let me share some listener comments. Seth tweeting at AirTalk, I think Democrats are, as usual, walking right into the GOP's trap. Impeachment battle doesn't move the needle. Screaming about single-payer tuition reform, social justice does, and Trump knows it. And share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Coming up, we'll talk about a historic case involving a young man who died in a skiing accident. His parents have won the legal right to use sperm retrieved from his body to produce a child, a posthumous child. We'll talk about that issue and the ethical implications right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. If you didn't know it already, you might be disturbed to find out very small percentage of the materials you put in the recycling container, things that you've carefully washed and put in there, very small percentage of those are actually being recycled now. And we'll talk about efforts in Sacramento to try and change that and to create a larger recycling and reuse market. That's to come next hour here on Air Talk. Right now, it's the case of a 21-year-old Bay Area native, Peter Zhu, who was a West Point cadet who died in a skiing accident. And he had given consent for his organs to be donated. After he died, not only were his organs removed, but sperm was retrieved from his body. And his parents went to court requesting the right to be able to use their late son's sperm to produce a child. Now, there is no precedent for this. spouses or domestic partners have been in the position where they could do that. Certainly, if someone had written out their intent to donate their sperm for use in creating a child, that would be very clear legally. But in this case, New York Supreme Court Justice John Colangelo ruled that since there isn't a law against the parents using their late son's sperm to produce a child, that they were legally entitled to do so. This raises a host of legal and ethical issues, and with us to talk about them, Dean-elect at the Chase College of Law at Northern Kentucky University, Judith Darr. She's also the chair of the Ethics Committee of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. Thank you very much, Dean Darr, for joining us on Air Talk today.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Larry.
So let's talk about first the absence of law here. It seems like just from my quick read of this, that's sort of what the judge was saying. There's not a law against this.
That's correct. And the judge relied on two pieces of law in New York that are related but not directly addressing this particular situation. And he looked at the organ donation law and the ability of the parents to consent to the retrieval. And he also looked at laws governing estates, the disposition of property after death. And from those, he reached what he called inferential emanations from these laws to permit the parents to consent and possibly use his reproductive material moving forward.
Under organ donation laws, are sperm and eggs treated as organs for the purpose of the law?
The law was drafted in the 1980s, and it doesn't specifically address a sperm and egg per se, but there have been interpretations of the law that extend to the ability to retrieve and donate these materials, and that's exactly what happened in this case.
But then it would seem it's still silent on the issue of whether you could use retrieved eggs or sperm for producing a child.
That's exactly right, because when one donates a heart or kidneys, it's used to sustain another person's life in the life that they have. But obviously, when we use gametes posthumously, they're used to create another life, and that has very different implications, both in law and in ethics.
And with the judge's ruling here, how much weight did they give? Apparently, multiple people testified to the fact that Peter Zhu, the young man, had said he looked forward to being a father, wanted to have multiple children. But of course, it's a very different thing to have one sperm used for children you will not be personally raising. There's no wife here or significant other who would be bearing the child. So is that something you can infer from the young man saying that he wants to be a dad?
Yeah, and we have to recognize that we all have an interest in our reproductive activity, whether it's during our life or even after our death. And the judge did give great weight to the fact that he was an only child, that he had talked about the import of family in his life, but there's no way that we could know, either now or in the future, if he would want to be a parent in this way. If he'd want a child to be born, which he wasn't able to participate in their rearing, in which possibly his parents would be this child's parents. It's just impossible for us to predict. And we take what is a very tragic situation with extremely well-meaning and earnest parents, and we do the best we can. And I think that's what happened in this case.
There are ethical guidelines from the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, for which you chair the Ethics Committee. Does it directly address this issue?
It does. And the judge cited our policy in the opinion. We actually take a different position than the one that the court took. We say that requests by spouses and life partners are appropriate, but we do not necessarily think that parents or other third parties are the appropriate decision makers. And so we essentially would have discouraged the court from acting in this way. We provide guidance. It's not law per se, and it's just an opinion that tries to look at all sides of the issue. And there are reasons why we took the position that we did, limiting retrieval and use to spouses and life partners. And if I may, just one of the main reasons is we can understand that a spouse or a partner would have a joint reproductive plan with the decedent, and that's appropriate. But on the other hand, it's really not appropriate. In fact, it's discouraged by law and policy for a parent to have a reproductive plan with their child. And just based on that appearance alone, in our discussions, we took the position that we didn't think it was appropriate for programs to move forward with requests by parents or other third parties.
We're talking with Judith Darr. She's the dean-elect at Northern Kentucky University's Chase College of Law and, as I mentioned, chair of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine's Ethics Committee. And this is her area of research right here, bioethics involved in reproductive medicine. Just one other issue. Is there any cooling-off period here where the parents are you have to wait before a child would be conceived using the sperm from their late son?
There's nothing formal in law that talks about a bereavement period, but mental health professionals highly encourage those who are in this position to take this, as you say, cooling off or bereavement period. And the recommendation is anywhere from 1 to 2 years. So nothing per se, but given the difficulty of the circumstances and then the time for reflection, I certainly agree with those mental health professionals.
Also joining us is Professor of Medical Ethics at New York University's School of Medicine, a frequent Air Talk guest with us, bioethicist Arthur Kaplan. Professor, thank you for being with us again. Do you differ at all in your perception of this decision from Dean Darr?
I don't. I think the dean is right, although I'm probably even more strong in my disagreement with the judge. I think trying to stretch the law governing organ donation to include reproductive material, sperm or eggs, is really stretching. Those laws had nothing to do and didn't even countenance the possibility of reproduction as part of what you were talking about when you filled out a donor card to be a kidney or a liver donor. And I also worry, you know, this means in vitro fertilization with a donor egg, someone that the parents would have to find to also be a surrogate. And so you have a third party introduced here whose rights and ability to become involved in parenting a child isn't at all clear. It could even be that the parents are older. I don't know how old they are in this case, but let's assume they were in their 60s and maybe they became ill or died. You have a situation where the child's best interest isn't looked out for without a dad, without these parents trying to parent the child themselves, and the stranger sort of lurking on the side. So I think it's very bad public policy to let parents do what's happening here.
We're talking about the case of a 21-year-old West Point cadet who died in a skiing accident. Peter Zhu of Concord in the East Bay area, San Francisco Bay area. After his death, his parents went to court to attempt to get the right to use sperm retrieved from their son's body so that a child could be conceived or children could be conceived using their late son's sperm. There is no spouse, no significant other here. New York Supreme Court Justice John Colangelo sided with the parents in the absence of specific law on this, said that they have the right to do so. Now, Art Kaplan, our guest, actually wrote the first bereavement waiting period for a hospital. That cooling off period that I had just raised a couple minutes ago. We'll hear more about that as we continue in 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. I have to say, our Air Talk listeners posting on the page, not fans of the judge's decision in New York State involving the sperm that was retrieved from a 21-year-old Bay Area man. He died in a skiing accident. His parents wanting the right to use his sperm that was taken after his death so that they could have a grandchild that would be created from their son's sperm. Judge siding with that Bay Area couple. We're talking with a pair of bioethicists, Arthur Kaplan from NYU, where he's professor of medical ethics, and Judith Darr, dean-elect of Northern Kentucky University's Chase College of Law. She chairs the Ethics Committee for the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. Art Kaplan, I just wanted to get a little bit more about this bereavement waiting period or cooling off period before gametes could be used by a spouse, significant other, or this one case by a parent. What are the criteria that you came up with for University of Minnesota's Med Center?
So this was 32 years ago.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. They could do the retrieval then, huh?
Yeah, and we had a gentleman die in the backyard from a cerebral aneurysm, brain blowout. His wife had heard me talking on public radio, of all things, about the possibility of sperm procurement. She said, I would like to do this. When they brought him to the hospital, he was pronounced dead, and she said, I'd like to do it. So we assembled quickly a team to figure out what to do. And I made a couple of points then, which was, one, I said, we might take the sperm, but we have to insist on a waiting period. My suggestion was 6 months. Judith mentioned that mental health people say maybe a year or two. But the idea was grief may pass and you may decide this isn't what you want. And in this case, it was the wife, not a parent, by the way. Also said maybe you cannot transfer the sperm to a third party. We even talked about that you could have one child, but not more. Wow. That still remains today. And in any event, we did procure the sperm, and interestingly enough, after 6 months, the wife said she did not want to go through with it, and the sperm was destroyed. So I've seen that a few times since then. People, once they wait, kind of come to terms with the loss and decide maybe the procreation isn't the way to go.
How widespread are these bereavement waiting periods?
Well, each infertility center is free to make up its own policy. As Judith said, there's no law in place here, so some have them, some don't. And some centers say they're not going to do any type of postmortem sperm procurement, even if it's a spouse or a partner. So it's all over the place.
Okay.
32 years ago, I thought we should have some legislation. Kind of still waiting.
Yeah, and there's a void there. I did want to raise the cultural aspect of this, which would seem to me as a non-lawyer, a little dicey for the judge to consider, but I'm going to share what's part of the filing of the Northern California family and get our legal scholar Judith Darr to comment. In the filing, it says, our family comes from China, and an extremely important part of Chinese culture is the tradition of carrying on our family heritage. And explains that while Mr. Zhu has two brothers, both of them have one daughter, in part due to China's one-child policy. And the filing goes on to say, in Chinese culture, only a son carries on the family's name. Peter's the only male child in the Zhu family. Now, Judith Darr, is that something that the judge would likely consider here, that cultural issue?
Well, the judge is free to consider whatever he thought was relevant, but let me make two points about that. First of all, cultural issues have figured into these decisions, not necessarily in the U.S., but in other countries. These situations have unfolded in Israel, in which, in those cases, soldiers have been killed and the parents have retrieved sperm and actually have gone on to have children. Now, whether they're children of the parents themselves or grandchildren is another story altogether. And they do so under the guise of kind of a cultural pronatalist environment in that country. And so let me just come back to the other issue here, which is what would be the relationship between any child and the parents? For example, even if the parents are older, let's say the mom is postmenopausal, we have the technology today to allow her to be the gestational carrier. Doesn't matter that she wouldn't be and shouldn't be the egg provider. She could be technically made medically ready to carry the child. And if she gave birth, in some situation, she'd be considered the mother.
And grandmother.
The child, yeah, and grandmother. So it creates this confusion. And in some cases, and we write about this in our ASRM opinion, it begins to simulate an incest union, which we really would want to discourage and stay away from. So I understand and honor the cultural sensitivities, but want to raise some of the complications that arise from considering those.
All right. Well, and back to the cultural issue that I was asking you about, then what would happen if the conception produces a female embryo? Then that wouldn't carry on the family name. That would not satisfy the particular issue that the Jews are trying to deal with.
Yeah, and that's a whole other area. I'd love to talk with you about that someday, the sex selection opportunity. And in most clinics, the parents would be able to select. And let's say, for example, that only female embryos were made, and then they decided not to proceed. I mean, that's a statement, cultural and otherwise, in and of itself, I think is problematic.
Art Kaplan, I want to come back to you to hear your prescriptives. What do you think legally would be beneficial to enact by law, and what do we individually need to consider with this stuff?
Well, one thing we ought to do is consider modifying California law and the other states. The Uniform Anatomical Gift Act only really covers organs, but it could be extended to cover post-mortem sperm desires about donating sperm and eggs, and by the way, uterus and testes and someday ovaries. These are being transplanted. They're reproductive too. So I think it's time to modify the law. Remember too, Larry, the only people who do this now are people who are somehow aware. Remember I mentioned hearing it on the radio years ago, but it's not routinely offered. The question is, should it be? When a young person dies and their spouse is interested, should they routinely have this offered to them? Another question, there are many, but the other one I'll mention is, should public money go for this? You know, we're using in vitro fertilization here. Judith mentioned testing embryos. That costs money. Is this something we feel people ought to have assistance with, or only the rich would be allowed to do it?
All right. So many different considerations and maybe a conversation with one's parents and spouse you never thought you'd have. So, Arthur Kaplan, bioethicist, professor of medical ethics, New York University School of Medicine. Art, thank you so much. And Judith Darr, dean-elect, Chase College of Law, Northern Kentucky University. And she chairs the Ethics Committee for the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. You can share your comments, pretty condemning right now, of the judge's decision in New York State. AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Lot to talk about in hour two. I'll tell you about it momentarily. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, we'll take a look at the housing bills alive in Sacramento to try and deal with the housing shortage. As we talked about last week, SB 50 died. That was the bill that would have overridden local zoning controls for construction of denser housing along transit ways. But there are other bills. We'll talk about those. And then later this hour, at the very end, Aretha Franklin apparently left behind three partially handwritten wills at her Detroit home. This leaves a judge trying to figure out, well, where there's conflict, which one supersedes the other. We'll open up the phones for you to share your horror stories about family wills gone awry, unclear, multiple wills appearing. That's coming up later this hour. But first, you know, as we have gotten so good at recycling, sad to say, the overwhelming majority of the materials we put in recycling containers go to landfills. They don't end up being recycled after all. The market has fallen out for recycling of many different materials. China is no longer taking huge quantities of those recyclables as they did in the past. And that's now left, by some estimates, only about 9% of plastics in the U.S. being recycled. A couple of bills that get at this issue of recycling claim about 15% of plastics are currently being recycled. KPCC Orange County reporter Jill Replogle with us to talk about some of these bills to try and deal with the problem. Jill, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, anything to add about why the bottom has fallen out of recycling and why so little of these materials are getting recycled?
Right. Well, for a long time, we were exporting our recycling materials, not just plastic, but also paper and all kinds of materials to China. And a couple of years ago, China decided to put severe restrictions on the kinds of material that it's taking in. And now it's not taking any of our recycling. And that has just really led to a big scramble among municipal waste companies to figure out what to do with that, all the stuff that we throw into our blue bins outside the house.
I was reading that that China, in taking all of those recyclables, but much of that they were just burning or discarding. They were taking everything, but they weren't actually recycling the majority of the materials they were getting.
Right. So, I mean, when you really track it down, we just pushed our problem overseas. Exactly. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. Some plastics are more easily recycled than others. Some is more, are more valuable than others. And sometimes, you know, it takes a lot more work to be able to separate out the good stuff from the junk. And you know, China decided that that was not worth its time and not worth its people's health.
Next week, we're actually going to do a segment on a type of plastic that apparently has been developed in the laboratory that when it's combined with other things, when you come to breaking it down, it very easily is separated from other materials and is able to be used potentially much more easily than current plastics for recycling purposes. So we'll be talking about that and see, well, what, you know, in the real world, how applicable is that? But in Sacramento, there are a couple of bills designed to create more of a recycling market. Jill, what would they do?
Well, there are actually a bunch of bills that deal with recycling in the legislature right now, but two big, very ambitious bills in the Senate and the House would require all manufacturers and sellers of products in California to make their products recyclable and actually prove that they're getting recycled by 75% by 2030. So the overall goal is to reduce plastic waste by 75% by that date, and then to phase out what we call single-use plastics, or, you know, to kind of disposable plastics, your water bottles, the wrapping on your packaging completely. So really ambitious bill. It's, you know, it has some vague language at this point. It's leaving a lot of the details up to Cal Recycle, which is the state recycling facility. And so they would be in charge of figuring out a lot of the details. But, you know, it's still early in the process as well.
And it sounds wonderful if in fact, this were to help create a bigger recycling market. But on the other side, the concern would have to be what additional costs would consumers bear as part of this.
Right. Yeah. And you know, I'm sure that is an issue. I think we're going to hear from some manufacturers to see what they have to say about that.
Barbara in Santa Monica just let us know Santa Monica has now taken the step of only accepting plastics number 1 and 2 in recycling bins because there's no market. Right. And I wonder if other cities are going to follow suit.
I have heard that other cities are following suit. And so, you know, things like yogurt containers, for example, are number 5. That's something that would not be taken. I mean, really, number 1 and number 2 are it's a pretty small percentage of the overall plastic that we consume normally on a daily basis.
So to talk with us about these companion bills that have been introduced in the State Assembly and Senate is Jeffrey Hollander, CEO of the American Sustainable Business Council, which is an organization of businesses committed to sustainability. Mr. Hollander, also the co-founder, former CEO of Seventh Generation, which sells household and personal care products that are billed as sustainable. Mr. Hollander, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
How would this mandate affect companies that sell consumer goods? How would their packaging potentially change?
Well, it would have to change, and it would push us to look at different solutions like reusable packaging, which is now being piloted in a program called Loop with large manufacturers like Unilever that are participating. We need to look at ways in which we can refill our own containers at the store level. We need to change the way we package consumer products. We need to change the way we behave as consumers, but this is doable, and it's critical that we do it. And business doesn't always like these types of changes, but it will push us to build the kind of innovations into the marketplace that will prevent the terrible environmental challenges we're now facing with plastic polluting the ocean, having an adverse effect on fish and other wildlife. So this is something we have to do. It's just a matter of when, where, and how.
Now, with the company you co-founded, Seventh Generation, how much of its total packaging is recycled?
Well, we're really, you know, we're really no different than the rest of the market. So we are facing the miserable recycling rates that other people around the country are facing. And the reality is that at least 100% of our plastic packaging is made from 100% post-consumer recycled materials. So even though the finished package is not being recycled, we made it completely out of recycled materials in the first place, so we didn't create new plastic to do that.
And would these bills allow for that, that the containers don't have to be necessarily recycled, but the containers would have to be made of recycled material? Or do these bills call for both ends of it, using recycled materials, and it must itself be recyclable?
Yeah, we would not meet that standard today. So we would have to deal with the fact that the packages are not being recycled. That's a big challenge. And I mean, I think, you know, you have to put this in context. I mean, we spend in the United States $26 billion a year propping up the fossil fuel industry. That money doesn't belong there. That money should be going into building up our recycling infrastructure, educating consumers, investing in innovative solutions. So we have a tremendous amount of money that is available that needs to be redeployed to really fix what is a broken system.
All right. I didn't understand from that if the bill would cause both. Jill, can you speak to that?
Yeah. No, I mean, the packaging would have to be recycled post-use. And, you know, I mean, it's great to use recycled material to make something, but then if it gets thrown again, you know, away again right afterwards, that at least delays it
one generation,
right? Exactly. And I just, you know, the other option for these for producers is to switch to something that is compostable, or to get rid of the packaging altogether. So, you know, I had a kid's birthday party last week for my son, and we bought some little toys to put in the pinata. I thought they would come just in one, you know, big box, but they all came individually wrapped in little plastic bags. So, you know, getting rid of some of that unnecessary packaging is also one way that manufacturers could potentially comply with this bill.
We've talked before about also bulk refills, where you'd go to a store and you take your container that you used for that product, you'd fill out a bulk, you'd pay based on weight or whatever the means is to pay for it. The challenge there is the burden that puts on the consumer, sort of the lack of practicality that you have to be carrying around your bottles, you know, back to wherever the store is.
Yeah, it does, you know, and organizations that are pushing for this bill recognize that we may need to really change the way we think about shopping and the way we, you know, assume that we can just grab something off the shelf and go. We might have to be a little more strategic about how we live if we want to get this done.
We're talking with KPCC reporter Jill Replogle, Jeffrey Hollander, who's in favor of the legislative bills, which would set a very ambitious mandate by 2030 of 75% of plastics used in California being recycled. Also with us from the American Chemistry Council, which is an association of chemical and plastics manufacturers, Tim Shestick. He's Senior Director of State Affairs. Ms. Shestick, thank you for being with us. Is this 75% attainable in just over a decade?
Well, first, thanks for having us on. And I would say the objective of what these bills are trying to achieve is something that we are in full agreement with. There was some commentary earlier about the situation regarding China and our recycling markets. We certainly recognize that. we certainly recognize it also as an opportunity to try to take a hard look at what we are doing in terms of our recycling infrastructure, new innovative technologies that are coming online to help deal with some of the more difficult materials to push through the mechanical recycling stream. So I would say, yeah, I think the objectives are achievable. Our organization and our industry has made some very ambitious announcements recently that we would like to see 100% of all plastic packaging be recyclable or recoverable by 2030. So we're not objecting to what these bills are trying to do. There are a number of details, a number of questions that need to be worked out, and that's where we are in the process now, working with Assemblymember Gonzalez, Senator Allen, Senator Skinner, and the other folks who are pushing the legislation to try to figure out those details, try to figure out what are some reasonable timelines that manufacturers would have to meet in order to achieve these objectives. And I think the big question and something that we need to figure out first is really assess what is our infrastructure here in the state of California. We need to assess what our collection, recycling, and composting infrastructure is. What are the materials that are being collected now? There was a comment earlier about some municipalities dropping certain materials. We have a real patchwork of collection infrastructure in the state. We need to assess that first, right, get a better handle on that, and then evaluate what sort of policies, incentives, tax credits, what have you, could be imposed that could help stimulate domestic markets for these materials that are being produced and collected.
What are the potential price increases on consumers to accomplish this?
Well, I think that's tough to tell. I mean, I think right now you have materials that, compostable materials, especially maybe in the food service packaging space, that are a little more expensive than your kind of run-of-the-mill plastics or other plastic-coated paper products that are out in the marketplace. But with it, I think with some sort of new regulatory scheme that could be ultimately implemented by CalRecycle, you know, there could be costs to consumers and manufacturers. And those are some of the unknowns that I think the business community has in terms of the regulatory uncertainty with the bills that are currently drafted now. How they're currently positioned is that most of these decisions, most of the fine details of what sort of regulatory programs are going to be in place, what sort of financing mechanisms might be required to implement some of these policies, are really all left to CalRecycle to figure out in the out years. And I think from our perspective and a number of other industry groups and businesses in the state, we need a little more regulatory certainty, and we'd like to see some of these details spelled out in these bills before they make their way all the way
through. Are you optimistic about technology assisting, whether it's, you know, new types of plastic that are easier to separate from other materials to aid the recycling process, cutting the cost of that? Do you hold out hope that that could make a significant difference?
I do. I do hold out hope that there's innovations that are taking place. Companies are operating around the country now, up in Oregon, in the Midwest, down in Texas, that are implementing chemical recycling technologies to take materials back to their original molecular state, and then those materials are then can be used as feedstock for the production of whether it's new packaging or other products. So I think innovation is happening. I would hope that the legislation that's moving through the legislature here in California would recognize innovation, make sure that we have all these different tools available to support existing recycling programs and then take advantage of some new technologies that can help further move material from disposal and into new markets.
We're talking to Tim Szestak of the American Chemistry Council, Association of Chemical and Plastic Manufacturers, Jeffrey Hollander, CEO of the American Sustainable Business Council. He co-founded Seventh Generation, which sells sustainable household and personal care products. He's in favor of these bills in Sacramento, which would phase out plastic products that aren't recyclable by the year 2030. The goal would be to reach 75% fully recyclable products. Jill Replogle, KPCC reporter, also with us.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I had a really interesting conversation with a woman who represents the plastics recycling industry. And, her group is really trying to work with producers of, like, your plastic bottle to make it, to design it in a way that makes it easier to recycle at the municipal level. So, you know, some things have multiple materials in them. So you might have several different types of plastic, and that makes it very difficult for it to be recycled. Or you might have, you know, the wrappers that sometimes go around bottles that stick to it, and that sticky stuff, you know, the whatever it is, glue, can gum up the system at your recycling facility, and that you know, causes all
you
kinds
don't have
of problems.
Pure plastic anymore.
Right. So just that, you know, the mere design of the product to begin with is a big factor in all of this.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Well, I've noticed, for example, the plastic caps to beverage bottles have changed recently for many of the brands into a different sort of material that I'm assuming is easier to recycle, and that is at least in part why they've done that.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, you know, caps are a big problem. I took bottles just recently to a recycling facility in Long Beach, and the guy said, yeah, don't bother with the caps because they're just too small. They won't get recycled to begin with. So, you know, small things are also a problem. There's actually another bill in the legislature that would try to, you know, outlaw hotels from giving out those tiny little plastic shampoo bottles and stuff, because those are often not recycled.
Yeah, how many of those are going to fill up landfills? Do we know, Jill, for example, with China not taking these recyclables as of a couple of years ago, are landfills starting to fill up more quickly? Do we know? Is that quantifiable now?
Well, I know that plastic is the second biggest component of our landfills. And I also know that, I mean, municipalities are definitely concerned about the fact that stuff is piling up. You know, we heard from the woman in Santa Monica. I also know that in Orange County, the recycling company in my part of the county or the waste management company is very concerned about trying to figure out what to do with this material that they say is just like piling up in their lot.
Randy in West Los Angeles, you know something about how they're dealing with this in Europe?
In the European Union, they started a consumer action where consumers would unwrap the product in the store just before the register or at the register and leave all the packaging in the outlets. And then the problem had to be solved between the manufacturers and the outlets, and left the consumer out, because they had this consumer action where they would just leave all that stuff in the store.
Interesting. So I guess the only potential problem would be if it's an item where you'd want the packaging to protect the item as you took it home. You wouldn't necessarily, for example, want to take your, you know, TV out of the box and carry it loose. But yeah, for some of the smaller, consumer sort of products, I could see that making sense. Yeah, I want to thank our guests for being with us. Jill, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Look forward to your continued coverage of this. And my thanks to Jeffrey Hollander and to Tim Shestick for joining us as well. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. As you might know, SB 50, the most controversial housing bill in Sacramento, died in committee last week. It would have overridden local zoning laws, allowing higher density construction along transit corridors. That's gone. But what other housing stimulus bills are in Sacramento, still alive in this legislative session? We'll take a look at that in just 1 minute. Throughout California, homeless populations have surged, and it's become one of the most difficult problems to solve in the Golden State. In Sacramento, there have been many approaches, including massive funding to try and create housing and services for those in need. One of the most controversial measures died in committee last week. It was SB 50 from Scott Wiener, the Democratic state senator from San Francisco. His bill would have overridden local zoning on transit corridors, would have allowed the acquisition of single-family properties to be turned into multi-unit structures, and that incurred the wrath of homeowners associations, neighborhood groups, both the LA and San Francisco so, councils and board of supervisors unanimously voiced opposition against Wiener's bill. So it died in committee, but the question is, what else is there that would attempt to address the homeless crisis in California? Sacramento Bee reporter who covers both the state legislature and politics generally, Hannah Wiley, is with us. Hannah, good morning. So what else is there to try and spur creation of housing and to deal with homelessness?
Sure. Good morning. Like you mentioned, SB 50 has died for this session. So really, there's not the powerful punch of overriding zoning laws. So really, at this point, there's just a couple of options that might help with the homelessness and affordable housing crisis. One or two Senate options are creating a partnership with local city officials and their zoning boards and the Capitol to pull tax revenues for affordable housing and infill projects. That's Senate Bill 5. And then Senate Bill 330 protects affordable units by prohibiting the demolition of housing projects that keep affordable options on the table for certain residents, and it prohibits downsizing. So those are two potentially powerful options, but they don't carry the weight that SB 50 did. And then, of course, you have a rent cap bill and a just cause eviction bill out of the Assembly. But again, those two face an uphill battle on the Assembly floor this week.
All right. You mentioned a bill that would prohibit downsizing. Can you elaborate a bit?
Yeah, sure. So Senate Bill 330 prohibits the downsizing of a unit. So essentially, if there's a zoning area that allows for, let's say, fourplexes or multi-unit homes, then this bill prohibits city officials from saying, well, now these are just going to be single family. This is going to be a single family area. So it makes sure that there is enough affordable units in the area for families that really need those options.
And is that happening, to your knowledge, very many places? Because it wouldn't seem that that reducing, you know, the densities of zoning, given the housing crisis, is something you'd be seeing much of.
Right. And, you know, Senator Wiener's bill touched on that a bit. That was a big part of the bill, is making sure that multifamily units could go up in areas traditionally limited to single family use. But that was a pain point for local city officials who said, that's our zoning regulation. We don't want the state to come in and say that we have to build additional units or change our zoning regulations. So, no, you don't see that very often, and that was kind of the point that SB 50 wanted to fix.
The Just Cause eviction bill that you mentioned, I think you said that would have an uphill battle. There's a lot of lobbying against that from the apartment owners and other property owner groups. In a case like that, there are some cities, aren't there, that have much more rigorous eviction protections? I'm assuming this would just take some of those and make them statewide?
Right, exactly. It would establish a just cause eviction and say that landlords and property owners have to give tenants considerable time to make other accommodations. And it also allows tenants the opportunity to contest a decision to throw them out of their home. But like you said, there's a lot of lobbying against this bill, considering that property owners and landlords want the opportunity to say, you're not paying your rent on time, or you're not the right tenant for this place, et cetera. I mean, they have their reasons, but this bill would really make sure that there's a just cause in that eviction.
Sacramento Bee reporter Hannah Wiley is with us on Air Talk. She covers the state legislature, and she's joining us to talk about some of the housing bills that are going in Sacramento, making their way through the legislative process. This in the wake of SB 50, which was by far the most far-reaching of the housing bills, dying in committee last week. It would have allowed for overriding local zoning of properties that are along transportation transit corridors. There was tremendous backlash to that, and so that did not get out of committee. But some of these others might have a chance for passage and being signed by Governor Newsom. There also is a proposed budget amendment that would make $500 million available for affordable housing tax credits for the next 5 years. I don't know how knowledgeable you are about that bill, Hannah, but is there any sort of a formula for how those credits would be allotted?
Right. So some of those would be allotted to farm worker housing, and that's really just to provide, like you mentioned, a budget trailer bill for low-income housing specifically. So while SB 50 had this sweeping opportunity to overwrite zoning and increase units, et cetera, this bill really focuses on low-income housing and the preservation and development of low-income housing, and it is up for a vote today on the Assembly floor.
Ah, okay. You also mentioned SB 5, which is the partnership state and local officials to accelerate affordable housing construction as well as infill projects. What is the partnership, just real briefly, intended to do, Hannah?
Right. So this bill has been called the medicine, or the sugar to help the medicine go down. It provides a financial stream that gives local agencies power to spearhead their own housing initiatives, but it really makes local governments focus on affordable housing and infill projects. So it would pull $2 billion from property tax revenue.
All right. Hey, Hannah, thank you very much. Appreciate you walking us through some of these other pieces of housing legislation.
Sure. Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Hannah Wiley, Sacramento Bee reporter, joining us on Air Talk. In just a moment, if you have a particularly fascinating story of wills gone awry, I'd like to hear your detail of that. Apparently, three separate handwritten wills, at least partial wills, have been found at the Detroit home of Aretha Franklin. When she died, the reporting was that there were no wills. So it was headed to probate, figuring out who's going to administer the estate, where the assets of the estate go. Now that's all thrown up in the air because of these three partially completed wills that were written at different times. I'd like to hear from you. If you had this happen with your family, multiple wills, a lack of clarity over the assets, how did you resolve it? We're at 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up right here on 89.3. New York Times reporter who's been covering the National Rifle Association and some of its recent drama will be Terry's guest. That comes up on Fresh Air, top of the hour, here on 89.3. I don't know if you saw the story about Aretha Franklin and her now very complicated estate. When she died 9 months ago at the age of 76, it was widely reported that she had made no will. And so the case, you know, going to a judge to decide who would represent the estate, make decisions on its behalf, how would her assets be distributed among her heirs. But then we get word yesterday that there were three handwritten wills discovered at her suburban Detroit home. Now, the question is, what happens with those wills, particularly when some of them were just handwritten with aspects crossed out and notes in the margins and the like? Do you take that to the bank as being a definitive will, or is she just outlining her thoughts at that given point in time? Complicated things for courts to consider. But I'd like to hear from you. If you had a particularly complicated situation with your family involving multiple wills and multiple kids and disputes over what happens to the estate, I'd like to briefly hear your experience and how you ultimately resolved it. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. With me is family law and estate planning attorney Jan Copley. She's principal at the Pasadena Law Group. Jan, thank you for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you.
We're not going to ask you to do individual legal advice for anybody because that doesn't work on the radio, but you can give us some of the general legal principles. So what are they going to have to decide in the case of Aretha's multiple wills?
Well, they're going to have to decide if any of them are wills, and if they are wills, which one applies. I can sort of tell you the general context under California law, which is you can leave a handwritten will. The official term is a holographic will. And as long as the dispositive provisions are in your own handwriting and it's dated and signed, it's an effective will. If you leave a series of wills, the last one operates. And if the last one contradicts provisions in a previous one, then the previous one is invalid. So my guess is that Aretha Franklin's last will, the 2014 one, would be the operative document.
And it doesn't need to be notarized. Oh. She can just handwrite a will, and as long as it's in her handwriting, it would be viable?
Yeah, notarization means nothing for wills. But basically, it has to be in your own handwriting, or the statute says the dispositive provisions. And California does have a statutory will form. You can pull it up on the internet, and if you fill it in and you do it, if you do it correctly, the court will probate it. In this particular case, I can see why the executor has submitted all three to say, okay, court, you decide what's happening. And they will need somebody to validate that that was actually Aretha Franklin's handwriting.
All right. And so apparently it could change the administrator who's responsible for millions of dollars in assets, not to mention all the revenue that the estate is going to generate because of her songs, her likeness, all the other things. She's an iconic figure. There's a lot of money that estate is likely to generate.
It would have been a complicated estate even if she'd done very formal planning. The last will, in fact, all of the wills talk about distribution of her stuff, and they're actually quite controlling. I want this to go to this person, and I want this much to go to this person. In the last will, I didn't see that she designated anybody in particular as her executor. So the current executor may stay, you know, it's a close family member, and that will really be up to the court.
All right. Well, let's take some listener calls. Shira in West Los Angeles. Sounds like you had a very complicated disposition of your father's estate. Describe for us what you dealt with.
My dad wrote about at least a dozen wills in his last 20 years. The last were written a few weeks before he passed away when he had dementia. He also married 6 weeks before he passed away, for spite purposes. So we're still battling it out. It's been about 3 years.
So you're still having this battled over in court. Now, your father had, how much? You said four marriages?
Yes.
Okay. Now, with all of his updating of wills, was that just reflective of his new marriages, or was this about people falling out of favor with him and him cutting them out of the will at various points?
It was mainly him being really spiteful or cranky. But to be honest, there were days where I would be in it, and then if we had an argument, he would rewrite it and say, "You're not in it anymore."
Wow.
And he would switch it again next week.
So it's kind of used punitively. I would assume that this has an effect on your memories of your father.
They weren't too great to start with, so it doesn't actually make a difference. But I was with him until the end.
All right, Shira, thank you for sharing that. Jan, how do attorneys in your case deal with this where you're, let's say you have a client coming to you all the time wanting to change their will because they're angry at a family member? Do you just do that, or do you try and, you know, talk them through that?
Well, it depends. It depends upon the circumstances. Shira says that her father had some dementia.
At the very end.
And, you know, as lawyers are not, we're not psychologists, we're not licensed people, but if we think if somebody has dementia, we should probably stand down from doing it. If we think that they're subject to undue influence, you know, this last marriage may or may not have been some form of financial elder abuse. We don't know. We may decline to do it. There have been a couple of times when I've had a parent come in and want to disinherit all of the kids, and I've said, well, by the way, you know, that's a good reason for your kids not to get along after you die, and they rethink that. So we have a duty to reflect the wishes of our clients, but we also have to make sure that they're really the wishes of our clients. And so in this particular case, it's the kind of case where you would think long and hard about taking the retention.
And in a case like the Shira's case, where she believes her father was suffering from dementia with the last couple of wills out of these dozen or so that he wrote, you'd have to go to court, presumably, to present evidence of impairment, right?
That's correct. You know, you can allege that the wills are not valid because, A, father didn't understand what he was doing, and, B, maybe he was subject to some undue influence. Now, dementia doesn't necessarily mean a will is invalid. You're supposed to have what's called testamentary intent. And testamentary intent is, you know, the natural objects of your bounty and you know the nature of your assets. And so even if you're a little off otherwise.
Short-term memory impaired, that wouldn't necessarily disqualify the will?
No, or if you have some really bizarre paranoia, but you pretty much know what's going on, then the will's probably valid.
Fascinating. We're talking with Pasadena-based attorney Jan Copley. She's principal at Pasadena Law Group. They specialize in probate, estate planning, administering of trusts. Again, I'd love to hear from you. Shira set us off very well with her call and about the tremendous challenges her family's going through with all of her father's wills and multiple marriages and dementia late in life. I'd like to hear your story succinctly, of course. If you're dealing with probate from hell, or you got through it, how did you deal with it? 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Back in 1 minute. Aretha Franklin passed away about 9 months ago, and at the time, the word was that she had died without a will, and that her estate would have to go to probate. There'd have to be an executor chosen, but that there was no indication necessarily of her wishes. Now the word is that three wills in various states have been composed, handwritten by Franklin, have been found at her suburban Detroit home. Now the question is, which of those is in force? And it brings to mind the question, if you are have gone through or in the middle of a very difficult case involving multiple wills or disputes over who the executor is, you know, a million things that can happen. How are you resolving it, or how did you resolve it? Joining us to talk about some of these issues, Jan Copley, principal of Pasadena Law Group. She's not able to provide specific legal advice. If you're calling in with a problem, she can't help you with it, can't give legal advice over the phone, but we can talk about some of the general issues that are raised. Edward in Northridge, are you involved right now in a difficult estate case?
Actually, oh, by the way, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Currently, no, we're not. It was more or less resolved under duress, you might say. In a nutshell, what happened was my father passed away, and leaving my mother, who was getting the onset of Alzheimer's, the will that they made was already made up, was certified, was notarized, the whole nine yards. And when my father passed away a number of years ago, they have a house in Vegas. They have a number of...
Yeah, I'm sorry I have to interrupt, Edward. I really need you to very succinctly state what the issue is.
Well, the issue was my sister took the will that my parents made and essentially shredded it. And she got a hold of an attorney, put herself as power of attorney, and null and void the previous will that my parents had already made up. And with my mother having dementia, she essentially took the estate, all the funds involved in it, and using the money as her, using the estate as her ATM machine.
All right. And Edward, you didn't have a copy of your father's will?
Oh, yes. My brother and myself did have it.
Okay. Yes. So even though it was shredded, you had a copy that you could present.
Well, shredding, what I mean is my sister tore it apart and essentially made up her own her own documents stating that she was in complete control. And it did go against the wishes. Well, what my sister did.
Okay, Edward, thanks. I appreciate your call. Jan, that, yeah, that's a particularly complicated case.
It happens more often than you would think. One parent dies and another parent is not doing particularly well. And unfortunately, the law presumes that the surviving parent is going to be fine, and they aren't always. And sometimes a child or somebody who knows that will take advantage of a parent who is not doing well, take them to an attorney or have them prepare a new will, which undoes the joint one that was done with the spouse. And then, of course, the family is left with the choice. Do you accept this new one? Or do you challenge it? And do you challenge it while mom is still alive? Because what I'm hearing is that created a new will in sister's favor, but also gave sister control of the money, and sister may or may not have handled it appropriately. Sister is a fiduciary. She has a duty to manage this money for mother's benefit, and anybody in that position cannot use the money for their own self-aggrandizement, but people do.
And are courts equipped to be able to track that? And I assume there's a lot of expense taken on by the challenging survivor to go through that process.
It can be quite expensive. And in this particular case, it would require going through all of mom's financial records to show what had happened and if the expenditures were appropriate or not. So courts are equipped to do it, but it's required by the family to bring it to the court's attention. You can't just sort of assume that somebody's going to step in for you. You can also call Adult Protective Services about family elder abuse, but you still need to be proactive about this.
Now, does that include financial allegation of financial malfeasance or only physical or mental abuse of an elder?
It includes financial malfeasance. Okay. It's a growing problem, is elder abuse, both physical and financial.
Let's talk with Brian in Lakewood. Pleasure to have you with us. So what did you go through?
Well, thank you. My father was in and out of an alcohol rehab for about the last 6 years of his life, the last 6 months. He was in a rehab center, and he apparently redid his will, and there were a bunch of people, individuals that my family did not know. And we had to hire attorneys. It took us about 14 months to have adjudication from the court system, but we had to visit state.
Yeah, you're breaking up, Brian. Sorry, we got a bad connection. So he goes into rehab, and 6 months before he dies, while he's in rehab, his will is rewritten with people that the family members don't even know as beneficiaries. That, at least on the face of it, sounds suspicious.
Well, that depends.
Necessarily.
Maybe dad was, I'm sorry, Brian, forgive me for being flip, but maybe dad was drying out and actually had some gratitude issues to these people. The other thing is, under the law, that if you are married, you have the spouse has statutory rights, and it's difficult to completely write a spouse out. But I can see where the family would have felt blindsided by this. And if dad left most of stuff to people that the family had never known, that might have been a good reason to at least take a good look at the will and see if dad really understood what he was doing, if anybody was unduly influencing him.
Yeah, and if he's going through withdrawal or something,
right,
he's not of sound mind to make those decisions.
Correct.
So when you're talking about that spousal right, is that a separate issue than community property in California, or kind of an extension of that law?
Well, the answer is both.
Okay.
Sorry. But with community property, Larry, you're married. Anything that you and your wife earn during the course of your marriage belongs half and half to each of you. So half of your paycheck from KPCC belongs to her. You each have the right to control it. But it means that when you die, you can, half of that money belongs to your wife, and you can't change its disposition. If you have separate property, which is property that you inherit or is property that you brought into the marriage before you got married, you can leave that to whomever you want. Your spouse doesn't have the right to control it. But on the other hand, she is entitled to a statutory share. And that statutory share, if you have only one kid, it's split between the kid and the spouse. If you have more than two kids, a third goes to the spouse and the other third gets split amongst the other kids.
All right. So when someone dies who's married, you're not obligated that going, your half is not obligated to go to the spouse. You could choose to give that to a child or anyone else you want.
KPCC, yes.
All right, you could do it. Let me quickly read. Duffy in Westchester says your father passed away several years ago, granted a small parcel of land in San Diego. Her mom became a trustee, and then when she passed, everything goes to a family trust. Only problem is title to the land was never put in the family trust. So sounds like they got into a bit of a jam there as well. Duffy, sorry to hear about that. Jan Copley, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your expertise. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
She's a family law estate planning specialist, principal of Pasadena Law Group. Jan Copley joining us on Air Talk. Coming up, Fresh Air with Terry Gross. A New York Times investigation into the NRA is the subject of Terry's conversation. And, of course, our news coverage continues with Eddie Lynn Hurdies and Nick Roman on All Things Considered this afternoon right here on 89.3 KPCC. Have a great day. I'm back with you tomorrow morning at 10.